welcome to our edition of Garden Talk on Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today as we talk about, first, how to successfully start seeds indoors. And we have a couple of guests for you. From the UW-Madison Division of Extension, our Kevin Schesso, the Ag Development Educator for Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn Counties. Kevin, good to have you back.
Good snowy morning to you, Larry.
Yes. And Bruce Spangenberg with us as well. He's the Extension Horticulture Educator for Iron County. And Bruce, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
As we talk with our two experts, I hope you'll join in with your own questions. What do you want to know about starting seeds? Or maybe you have some other preseason tasks that you want to talk about. Maybe something that happened last year. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Bruce, you're new to the show, so tell us about your horticulture background.
Okay. I'm actually unretired to come here in Iron County. My career was down in Illinois, Northern Illinois, with University of Illinois Extension. I started out in a county job in McHenry County, went to a regional position in Northern Illinois, and then the second half of my career was at McHenry County College in Crystal Lake, Illinois. I was the horticulture department chair and also instructor there. So I retired in 2020, right in the middle of COVID, and then was looking to stay, you know, get something in horticulture. I didn't want to go back work full time, but then this position came open here in Iron County and it was a perfect fit. So I've been here since middle of December.
And responsibilities in this position?
Iron County residents, either home horticulture or commercial, answer questions, work in the media, teach seminars, plant diagnostics, that type of thing.
Well, you guys, you seem fully prepared to answer questions today for sure. So we're really glad to have you with us.
Thank you.
Kevin, let's just start with you. What are some advantages of starting seeds indoors? Your mind.
Yeah, well, I always like to ask people the question, you know, why are you doing this and what is the goal? And seed starting indoors certainly has its pros and cons. And the first one is you have to have the love and joy of watching a little seedling grow and then taking care of it, right? And if you don't have the time and patience or the adequate space, because after all, these plants are going to be living in your house or in some kind of heated structure. That's why we're doing this, after all, is we want to get a jump on the season and produce these beautiful transplants that we can set outside. So that's the first thing that you have to consider if you're going to be doing any seed starting inside is, do you have, you know, adequate light, you know, a nice south-facing window or a light table, and do you have other space needs once those little seedlings get bigger, because you can have 100 tiny little tomato plants in a really small space, and you know darn well what you got to do with those after a week or two. They need to be transplanted into a bigger pot, and then all of a sudden you go from 1 square foot of needed space to, you know, 100, you know, depending. So you just have to keep that in mind. But I really enjoy starting seeds because I know the varieties that I can plant. I have control over the quality of that transplant. Not that you don't get good quality transplants from a local source, but there's just being involved in that process from the very beginning. So that's my primary reason. And there's also this whole concept of extending the growing season and increasing our productivity of our plants by using transplants and setting out a robust transplant as soon as we can, you know, without frost injuring it. So we can, get earlier fruit, more harvest, maybe better quality harvest. And then some plants, we just don't have the length of growing season to plant that seed in the ground and have the chance of harvesting, ripe fruit from that. You know, and tomatoes and peppers and eggplants are the primary vegetables that I always think of as, well, those are ones we definitely want to do as transplants, whether you start the seeds or somebody else does. So, yeah, there's a lot of pros and cons, but that's kind of my main reason.
You know, Ted and Spooner has something that relates right to this, so let's just go there. Ted, hi, thank you for calling.
Yeah, hello. I want to know, when am I supposed to really start to say pepper plants, tomato plants, cabbage, and broccoli? And they're all different. I got asparagus started already and onions going.
You have a greenhouse?
Yes. Homemade one. It ain't very fancy, but it's kind of, it works.
All right.
Right. So this is probably one of the more challenging questions is, you know, when to start seeds. And you're right here, just down the road from where my office is here in Spooner somewhere. So I know about our local growing conditions and when we typically have that last killing frost in the spring. So that killing frost date is kind of the set point when we look back and how many weeks prior to that frost date do we need to be starting seeds so that we have that robust transplant come late May, early June. If you're in the southern part of the state, you probably can add 3 weeks to maybe even a month to that last frost date, and that dictates when we actually start putting seeds in the ground. So some transplants, like you mentioned, the leeks, shallots, onions, if you're doing seeds, those take a very long time to form a big enough transplant. So those are 10 to 12 weeks prior to the last frost date. So those are ones we should have started already, like you indicated. And now we just keep looking at that calendar and saying, what's the next group of plants that need to be put in the seed starting calendar so that by the mid or late May, we can set them out. So peppers and tomatoes are typically in that 4 to 6 week range. Eggplants might take a little bit longer. And then some of our herbs, they might be in that 8 to 10 week range. We always have to look at the seed packet or do our research, you know, on the species or the variety we have. And they often say, you know, start seeds indoor so many weeks before the last killing frost. So that's how I always think about when to start seeds is in Spooner here. May 23rd is about our average last killing frost date. I always say Memorial weekend is when it's safe to plant all of our warm season crops outside. So some of our cool season crops, kale, Swiss chard, some of our cold tolerant lettuces, those we can start a little bit sooner and plant them outside because they're somewhat frost tolerant. So those you might plant out in the beginning of May versus the end.
Yeah.
So it's all based on that frost date.
I'm always a little leery about getting those, especially pepper plants, out. I don't want to cheat and start too early on those because I've had that situation where you do get a cold snap and then you wind up maybe with some beautiful looking plants, but you're not getting any fruit or very little fruit.
Right. And this is another one of those things we have to check ourselves on is don't start too early. You may think, you know, with our above average temperatures we've been having all winter that, oh, I can, you know, start things a week or two earlier. And you're only taking more risk when you do that. And the other thing that we've learned over the years of, you know, working with transplants is an older transplant, a taller, maybe more root bound transplant is not necessarily going to give you more benefit than one that is a week or two younger. You know, you still want to have a big enough plant set outside, but a great big giant one isn't necessarily ideal either.
Yeah.
Ted, I hope that Bruce, did you want to add something to that?
No, I was just going to echo that. And we used to have plant sales when I was at the community college, and a lot of times people look for the biggest transplant, and as Kevin said, that's not necessarily the best route to go. Yeah. The smaller, healthier one's going to get off to a much better start.
Ted, thank you. I hope that helped. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us, email address, ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. Our guest today, Kevin Shesso, the Ag Development Educator for Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn Counties, and Bruce Spangenberg, he is the Extension Horticulture Educator for Iron County. Tyler Ditter is our Technical Director today. Jill Nadeau, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you with us for this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guests from UW Division of Extension. Kevin Shesso is the Ag Development Educator for Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn Counties. Bruce Spangenberg is the Extension Horticulture Educator for Iron County. So great to have both of them with us. And again, join in 800-642-1234, email to ideas@WPR.org. Gene in Ironwood, Michigan has a comment or an experience to share. Hi, Gene.
Yeah. Hi. How are you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Yeah. A few years ago, I've had gardens for years, but my neighbor here in Ironwood, they started a few tomato plants and a few other things, and she asked me one day. She says, "Where can I get corn transplants?" And I try to keep from laughing in her face, but I chuckled to myself and thought, "Yeah, come on." So anyway, a few years ago, I tried an experiment. I started my corn inside, and it germinates within about 3-4 days. I've got a heat pad and one of those little containers with the plastic dome, and in about 2 weeks, I've got plants, and I transplant them out into my garden. But, you know, I just do small patches, maybe 30, 40 at a time. And it works absolutely amazing. And I get like a 2-3 week jump on anybody else with my corn.
Well, and Gene is in Ironwood, Michigan, so getting a jump on it is probably not a bad idea. Just to think about, what do you think, Bruce?
Yeah, that's right across the border from us. I mean, those are things like, you know, Kevin alluded to, you're trying to get a jump on the season. And sometimes the struggle is, do you, you know, you start inside and then you move it outside. Do you shock the plant when you do that? And it sets you back versus seeding outside. The other thing to look at, I know sometimes people experiment with corn, but it's done more with crops like melons and even tomatoes and eggplant, is you work with row covers, you know, either floating or supported ones after the plant's outside, just to kind of have a jump on the season by creating kind of a mini greenhouse right out in the field. And there again, you're going to get 10, 14 days ahead of the schedule by doing that versus a plant sitting out in the open. And I'm sure Kevin's done a lot of that at the research center.
Yeah, Kevin, comment?
What? Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, that's one of our challenges being further north in the state, is that we do have, you know, historically a shorter growing season. And, you know, we do have short season varieties that, you know, adapt to that. But yeah, anything we can do up here to get another week or sometimes two with season starting strategies like Gene mentioned here are all part of the nuances and the creativity that our gardeners have to employ up here. And that's what makes gardening so fun. You can try these things.
Absolutely.
And now you got bragging rights, you know, with your neighbors, right?
Yeah. Gee, that's a great story. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. You know, thinking about growing mediums, you know, what's the, you know, for starting seeds, let's go back to that for a minute. What's the best growing medium for seeds starting?
Yeah, this is another one of those three biggies. I already mentioned the light source. Bottom heat is very helpful, too. Of course, we got to have water. But the medium that we plant those seeds in is really important. And I think most people who have done this and are experienced gardeners know that we are not advocating using native soil, mineral soil, anything that you're going to kind of dig up out of the ground and use as a starting mix. It should be something that's fine, high organic. It's usually a mixture of perlite, vermiculite, and some kind of organic, like sphagnum moss, or there's this other material called cor, C-I-O-R. It's shredded coconut hulls. And basically, that just provides a very fluffy, loose material that won't compact very easily, because those tiny seedling roots need air. They obviously need water and access to some nutrients. But if it's too compactable, then we're going to have problems with dampening off and other issues with the root. So what we call is a soilless mix. And there's different formulations, but the germination mixes, I find, have finer particle sizes that don't interfere with that little cotyledon coming out of the seed. If you have great big chunks of bark or other larger pieces of organic material in there, sometimes that gets in the way of those seeds as they germinate. Again, depends on the seed. So soilless seed starting or germination mix, you can purchase all these, you know, at various places. Or you can try to make your own, but you've got to have the right, you know, starting material. So I just suggest for $5-$10, you can buy a bag of starter mix and away you go.
Yeah. Yeah. Makes, makes good sense. Josh emailed, I don't have worries, what part of the state he's from, but he wonders when do you get your potatoes in the ground when you're going to plant into potatoes?
There's those Farmer Almanac sayings that I think about that says, you know, plant your potatoes on Good Friday or something like that, if I'm not mistaken. And there's certainly something to be said about phenology and timing and phases based off of nature. Or we just had a huge flock of robins show up, you know, and that's another sign that, hey, I should be starting seeds, at least in my mind. When, oh, when I see robins, it's like, yep, it's about that time. But potatoes, you know, those are tubers that we plant in the ground. And just like any plant, you have to have the right environmental conditions for it to decide that it wants to germinate and come to life. And soil temperature being the primary one. And potatoes can't take much cooler soil temperatures than, say, something like a warm season pumpkin or watermelon or bean seed. So because of that, it's not uncommon to plant potatoes in one of the very first you know, vegetables we plant, and that could be as early as mid-April. But I like to base it off of soil temperature, and we better have soil temperatures at least in the mid-40s before I'm thinking about planting a potato piece. So that's my guiding principle, is just keep that soil temperature in mind, and calendar is important, and you know what the current weather conditions are looking like, but they'll sit there dormant until they're ready to germinate. So yeah, you could plant them when the ground is thawed, but they may not germinate for another, you know, and then they could rot too. So
Bruce, anything to add there, Bruce? You were nodding yes about the rotting part of it.
Yeah, that's typically it. You know, gardeners want to get out there, and you get it. You know, mild weather in March with no snow on the ground, it's so tempting to go out there and start planting. But as Kevin said, that soil's got to warm up, and, you know, it's just how much a risk you want to take. But the best thing is hold off if you can, get into April at least before you really start doing that, because, you know, we're looking at the forecast now. We're looking at a lot more snow we had all winter coming possibly in the next few days. So, it's best to wait.
Yeah, as snow. Yesterday I drove home and noticed that one of my purple hyacinth was all nicely bloomed, and I thought, oh, I should run out and take a picture of that, and then I didn't. got involved in the housework and I forgot. And this morning when I woke up, it was completely covered with snow.
Yeah.
And probably that's a good aside question. I mean, you've got I have daffodils up, hyacinth up, and now we got snow, but they're pretty good at surviving this kind of a situation, Bruce.
Yeah, and actually, assuming more cold weather's coming, the snow is actually a good thing. It'll insulate them, but you're right. They can tolerate that to a certain extent. The worst is when they get into bloom, and this has happened before. You know, we get a stretch of really nice weather, and all of a sudden we're in single digits, and then they freeze, they wilt. But and they're not going to die, but obviously you lost the flower for that spring.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You can join in, too, with your garden question. The number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us, and the email address, ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. Here's another question that comes from Pat. He volunteers at an organic vegetable garden at his church. Last year, they found jumping worms in a couple of their beds. Other than picking them up and sealing them in plastic bags, is there something it can do to the soil before the start of our planting season to eliminate them? Bruce, did you have jumping worms in Illinois?
No.
Oh, you didn't?
Not that I was aware of. Yeah, that's a new issue. You know, we deal with exotics and invasives. That's one that's obviously a big concern, in particular with in the nursery industry. You know, if you're shipping material out of an area that's known to have jumping worms present, there's guidelines you need to go through to assure that you're not sending those with your nursery stock to another area that currently doesn't have that. And that's an ongoing issue with all types of invasives, but this one is more difficult because, you know, it's harder to see. It's in soil medium versus, you know, an invasive plant. You can see it, blooming, that kind of thing. But yeah, that's going to be, there are some procedures. Kevin, I don't know.
Kevin's probably may have something on that. Kevin?
Well, yeah.
Well, this is one of those questions, Larry, that we know there's answers. We just need to find the appropriate resource. So this is something that's been around for probably a decade now, and we definitely want to continue to educate gardeners about this invasive species. And why it's so much concern is that they're voracious eaters, and they'll really destroy the duff layer and make the soil kind of dry and crumbly. You always think of worm castings as something that's good, and having worms aerating and working in, you know, concert with the rest of our soil ecology. But in this case, they're over aggressive, just like terrestrial invasive plants or aquatic invasive plants. They outcompete, and they do other things that aren't good for the ecology. So we definitely want to educate ourselves about them. But I'm assuming if we did an internet search on jumping worms, Wisconsin DNR, mm-hmm. would be my first search, you know, yep. cue. And I'm sure you'll find all kinds of resources. I don't know if there was Bernie Williams, and maybe you've had her on in the past, but she was a person that I always associated with this topic at the Wisconsin DNR. But the internet should be able to provide us a little more information on this one.
Yeah, and they do. The DNR does have pretty much all of what you can possibly try to get rid of them. But it's a very tough problem because all right, you might see the worms, but then there's other little egg masses or whatever they are almost microscopic. You can't see them in the soil, but they're still there, and getting rid of it is just a big problem. Barb in Wausau has a question. Let's go there, and then we'll get to William in Green Bay. But first, Barb in Wausau.
Hi. thanks for taking my call. I have a problem with the gnats indoors, and I try to do everything right, and every year I have this problem with them stinking little gnats.
In your seedlings?
So, in my seedlings, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that, if you're talking about fungus gnats, the biggest thing there, it's a combination of organic matter and moisture. So that's always an issue. We always had those in our greenhouse because human nature is, especially with students, you like to water plants. You don't want them to wilt, so you water them too much. And the fungus gnats thrive in wet soil with organic material. So the number one thing we usually tell people first, if you can, allow the soil to dry out more before you water again. You know, there are some chemical materials available. We usually shied away from those and just went with the watering, you know, adjusting the watering, and they usually go away.
Yeah, and it is easy. I mean, you look at the top of the soil and it looks dry, so you throw some more water in, but just a little bit underneath that top layer, it might be wet, and that's where the problems come in. So watch your watering a little bit on that, Barb, and hopefully that'll help keep the gnat problem under control. William in Green Bay, we'll go to you. Hi, William.
Yeah, I have some corn and peas that I've planted in those little peat pots, you know.
Yep.
And right now I have them under a grow lamp. I had just moved into a new house, and there were some grow lights left behind. And I'm just kind of wondering, I'm a little worried that they're going to get too big before I can actually put them in the ground. Because they're just in the little, you know, the little peat pots that expand when you put water in them.
Okay.
They're 2 inches tall right now.
The corn plants are 2 inches tall?
They're maybe an inch.
And the pots themselves are, what's the depth of the pots? Are they like an inch or 2 inches? Or?
Yeah, they're the bigger ones. The ones that you buy, at like I bought them at Ace Hardware, and you put them in, and then they expand. I've also got some tomatoes. The tomatoes are just little seedlings right now. But the peas and the
corn.
The corn are growing because I've got them under these grow lamps, and I'm just
What do you think, Kevin?
Yeah, this is a case where we've got the biological clock is now ticking. By the way, congratulations on your success in starting these plants, and now you are a caretaker of these plants. And you're right. There is a concern about what to do with these when we don't have the right conditions outside appropriate for those different species. So peas are a little bit more cold tolerant than the corn, but the corn likes warmer temperatures and soil temperatures closer to that upper 60s to low 70s. So we are several weeks away, even in Green Bay, I'm assuming, from outdoor soil temperatures that are going to allow us to sit that plant outside. So I would just keep, enjoying that corn plant. It's going to eventually want to live out its life cycle, depending on how many days to maturity that particular variety is. But, you might need to put it into a bigger plant, a pot, before you're ready to take it outside, but you're going to have to wait until we get warmer soil temps for that corn. The pea, you could maybe try, in another week or two, depending on the weather, in a protected spot. And tomatoes, you're right on track. Just keep them going too.
All right. There you go, William. Thank you so much for calling. William mentioned the pots that he had. I mean, what are the best containers for seeds? I suppose that depends again on the type of plant.
Yeah, Kevin, go ahead. We're looking at each other.
Go ahead, Bruce.
Go ahead, Bruce. Go ahead.
I mean, there's different ways to do it. William was talking about. I mean, the peat pot. The idea is it's self-contained. You put the seed in there, and you can take it from there. Hopefully, grow it in the house and then put it outside all in one one activity. More often what's done is you seed and then do some transplanting in the greenhouse into a larger pot or flat, whatever you're going to do, depending on the volume, that type of thing, and then you move it outside. So there's no one answer to that question. It just depends on, you know, what you're doing. You know, a homeowner with relatively low volume versus a commercial greenhouse with high volume, you know, that's going to dictate a lot of what you want to do. But it goes back to the basics Kevin talked about. You know, you have to have the light, the temperature, the moisture, and good medium irregardless. A lot of times my experience with those peat pots is they tend to stay too wet because people tend to overwater, and then they kind of disintegrate a little bit, versus using a medium in some type of a container might be a better route to go. And the other thing with peas to think about, and it's trial and error. I know, you know, like we said, a lot of people want to get going and see stuff growing in the house, but you're probably better off direct seeding peas outside at the appropriate time rather than trying to start them inside and then go through the transplanting process to shock them and worry about, you know, what's going to happen with the weather. Mm-hmm. Just wait for the soil to be right. And they can tolerate cold weather, but obviously not frozen soil.
Yeah, that for when you mentioned tomatoes, I got to thinking back to the first time I ever grew some tomato plants inside from seed, and I took them out and stuck them outside into the ground, and then I went out the next morning and they were looked like they had been completely drained of their chlorophyll and they were laying on the ground. And this whole business of sort of weatherizing your plants, especially something like tomato, I learned that lesson very early. But comment on that.
Yeah, the hardening, or Kevin, I'm sorry, go ahead. You're going to...
No, go ahead.
There is that hardening off, and that holds true with everything. If you go to the garden center and buy not only vegetable transplants in the spring, but annual flowers, the greenhouse environment is usually a perfect environment. You know, it's humid, there's light there, but then you put them outside, there's a shock on that plant because in particular, the humidity changes, the extremes in temperature change from day to night. Mm-hmm. You get wind involved, so you want to give them a gradual change, you know, harden them off a little bit, move them back in the greenhouse, do that for a few days, gradually having longer and longer time outside before you actually put them in the ground outside. Because most often, if you take a plant right out of a greenhouse and put it right outside, like you said, Larry, you come back the next day and it's wilted or it's worse because it's such a shock changing that environment.
Yeah, I had to go and buy some plants.
Well, that's why we have local greenhouses, right, Larry? Because there are reasons to be able to go and purchase transplants rather than go through all this effort that, you know, some of the things we're talking about. And it's, like I said, it's not for everybody. But if you do have to replace plants, it's awfully nice if you can just go find those transplants at a local nursery or greenhouse, or maybe you've got, you know, friends and family that are into all this and you can trade, you know, transplants, because these things do happen. I think of a couple years ago here at the research station, we've got a small greenhouse and we were doing exactly what Bruce was talking about with our tomatoes, and we had them in and out and they were getting kind of big, and it was late enough in the spring where we were leaving them out longer, and a hailstorm popped up out of nowhere, and I didn't even give it a thought until after the storm, and every one of those tomatoes was shredded. So some still lived. The growing points, you know, they'll survive, but, you know, we had to make adjustments.
Make adjustments. That's what we have to do sometimes when it comes to gardening. Kevin Chesso, one of our guests today, the ag development educator for Burnett Sawyer in Washburn Counties, and Bruce Spangenberg is the extension horticulture educator for Iron County. Our guests here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my guests from UW Extension, Kevin Chesso and Bruce Spangenberg. Great to have both of them with us. Garden questions, give a call. The number's 800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. You know, one of the things we wanted to talk about was pruning, and Perry in Oconto has a question relating to that, I believe. Let's go there. Perry, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hey, Larry. Question about pruning. It's kind of late in the season now. Can we still prune? It looks like some of the trees are starting to bud out a little bit.
Yeah. And what kind of plants are you thinking of pruning, Perry?
What's that?
What kind of plants were you thinking about pruning, or what kinds of trees or shrubs?
It's just a tree like aspen trees and a couple box elders, which aren't great, but they provide shade. And how much can I take off of a tree?
All right.
Well, first of all, it's not too late. Even though trees are, you know, some of the buds might be swelling because we have had unusually warm weather. You know, the dormant season is ideal, and you can go into the spring when the trees already have leafed out. But it's, you know, we suggest dormant just because it's easier to see what you're doing. And also, as far as the wounds you make, the trees actually callus those over faster this time of year than they do later. So you got plenty of time. You know, the question how much to take off, it depends on the plant. You know, there's different rules as far as percentages. A lot of people say a quarter to a third, maybe maximum. You know, a tree like a box elder, to be honest with you, you could butcher that tree and it'll recover. It's pretty hard to damage a box elder, but I would use that, you know, quarter to a third rule, and then look at what's your objective. Is it tree too dense? Is it lopsided? Is it too tall? You know, what do you want to do? And then the basic rules, you always want to make sure if you're removing limbs to cut them back to another limb. You know, try to maintain, if there's a leader on the tree, maintain the shape, that kind of thing. But avoid leaving a stub. You know, sometimes people top a tree off at a certain height. You know, unfortunately, we see that a lot around utility lines where someone, you know, they come in and just cut it because it's too tall. You always want to take the time and effort to cut it back to have a new branch take over that direction that tree is growing, the portion that you're cutting. And smaller branches, always cut back to a bud. Don't leave a stub. You know, those are kind of the basic rules. But, you know, aspen and box elder, both of those are pretty easy to prune because they're pretty vigorous trees that grow fast. And, you know, they're going to rebound. And remember, the basic response that a plant has when you prune it, it's going to grow more. That's what, you know, you initiate growth on buds that are sitting there dormant. So you've got plenty of time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And if I might add, Larry, the other thing that we want to also remind people is that we don't really advocate putting this pruning seal or tar over the wounds. Bruce already mentioned if you're doing it during this dormant or semi-dormant period, the plant has ability to kind of callus over and dry. It's not going to completely compartmentize and swallow up that cut like will happen given, you know, the enough time. But when we cover it with a pruning seal, we tend to be including moisture and not allowing that wound to just naturally dry. You'll see weeping and sap flow coming off of cuts, which is normal. But at some point, those cells are going to kind of desiccate and dry up, and the bleeding will slow down, and the natural process of that wood just drying out is what we're after. And the only time that I ever see pruning seal mentioned is oak wilt. We don't want to have a lot of damage and pruning of oaks after about mid-April because of the oak wilt fungus that's transferred by sap beetles. So in the growing season, we might put down a sealant on oaks if we're concerned about spreading oak wilt.
There you go. That was a really good answer. As you were talking about the oaks, I was thinking about the big lawsuit that occurred some years back here in Wisconsin, where an area where I hired a tree trimmer who was not really trained and pruned a bunch of oaks, and along a lake. and did it in July. The oak wilt spread from one house to the next neighbor, to the next door neighbor, to the next door neighbor, to the next door neighbor, and a whole bunch of very mature oaks went down as a result. And there was quite a lawsuit, because a tree like that, you got a mature oak tree, that's worth a lot. A lot of money.
Yeah,
Kevin.
Right? No, it's a perfect example of why we want to educate people about proper horticulture practices, BMPs, you know, this integrated pest management I've mentioned in the past, and all the things we can do to properly work in, you know, together with nature and understand, you know, that this is how biology and ecology work together, and some of these pests are going to take advantage of the situation if we give them the chance. So, yeah, that's unfortunate. And oak wilt is still happening. It's pretty active up in this part of the state now. For a long time, it was just like a lot of pests. They sometimes spread from east to west or north to south, and that's that whole, you know, travel, you know, hitchhiking with our people, right, as people move around and stuff. So oak wilt is still pretty active up here, and it's still relatively new. Further downstate, you've probably heard about this for more than two decades now, and we just need to continue to do things cautiously and hopefully protect those big mature trees, because you don't want to lose those. You know, a 100-year-old tree doesn't replace itself overnight. So
it sure doesn't. Well, some emails we should attend to here. Marcia emailed to ask if it's okay to use store-bought potatoes to, you know, cut up and plant and grow potatoes in the garden, or does she need to buy seed potatoes?
Well, I'm going to be kind of the naysayer here on this, and the fact that, yes, you probably could just as well use store-bought potatoes. What we don't know is, has there been a sprout inhibitor put on those potatoes, which may or may not have happened. But we need to have viable eyes that have the little sprouts. And anybody who said forgot potatoes underneath the kitchen sink or someplace in the back of the refrigerator this time of year, they'll be sprouting, right? You know, so if they're sprouts, you know they're going to be fine. But the other thing that I've seen is we can be transmitting diseases, especially viral diseases, if you don't have a certified disease-free seed potato piece. Yeah. So that's where I rather see people purchase them at a reputable, you know, greenhouse or nursery center, garden center, if possible. But with that said, we do know that seed saving, all kinds of plant materials propagating happens, and there's a lot of satisfaction in that. So just know the source, and I've got leftover seed or potatoes from last season still in my basement, and they were grown organically. I knew how those seed pieces or plants were managed. They were relatively disease-free when we harvested. The tuber looks healthy. Those I might be more inclined to use as seed pieces because I know the history. Not so much so, you know, with the store-bought stuff. So nothing ventured, nothing gained. You know, see if you can find some, you know, actual seed piece, you know, certified seed potato if possible.
Yeah. And they're not really all that expensive when you get right down to it, for sure. Del in East Dubuque, Illinois, your turn. Hi, Del.
Yes, hi. I appreciate you for taking my call. Thank you. We've got probably about 8 acres, and it runs down into a bottom next to a river. And on part of the way, probably about an acre's worth, is just covered with, you know, the thicket of wild, like, raspberries. They don't seem to produce anything, but I'd just like to get rid of them so a person could even walk down that way. Any suggestions?
Bruce, what do you think?
It's not going to be easy. Yeah, a couple of things to the wild raspberries. And it, just a side note on that, that's a serious concern. You know, Kevin was talking about certified potatoes. Wild raspberries are a serious concern with viruses spreading to our domestic raspberries. So for any listeners that have wild brambles adjacent to ones that they've, the domestic ones they've planted, that's always a concern with disease. But getting back to your question, you know, there are some, you could try some broadleaf herbicides. You run into issues, you know, what else is there as far as trees and other plants that you want to keep. You have to be really careful because it's going to be very, very difficult to find the appropriate herbicide that's going to be selective and just kill those raspberries and not damage other stuff. Or you also have to look at herbicides. Some persist in the soil, some do not. Some are just foliar. You know, I don't have a recommendation sheet in front of me. I'd have to look that up. But, you know, you could try some herbicides are going to work when the plant has to be leafed out. So it absorbs the herbicide, then it moves down what we call a systemic herbicide. Glyphosate or Roundup is one of those. A lot of the broadleaf herbicides that are used on turf grass work the same way. They can be used on brush, but they're not selective. They're going to kill other plants. So you could spot treat those. You can try digging them out. The problem with them, you know, they do have a rhizome type growth underground. So you cut one plant off, it's still there underground. It's going to create more plants. So you have to do some digging out. So I'd have to refer to a, and maybe Kevin, you've got a quick source we can give him, but no, he's waving no. you know, we could, what you could do with that, we have, we're going to mention this, I think, anyways, we do have an Ask Your Gardening question on online through UW Extension. I would post that question, and that would give us some time to look up some herbicides that might work specifically in that situation. You know, some of the general broadleaf brush herbicides, I'm sure you could use those, but like I said, you have to be so careful because they're going to damage other stuff, or they're going to leave a residue in the soil that's going to affect other stuff you want to plant there later. You also mentioned you've got the water, the river there, or the lake there. That's a concern also. If that herbicide gets into the water, what effect does it have on aquatic vegetation or aquatic life in general? So it's a tough question. You know, this, the non-chemical route obviously is dig them out, but that's going to be something you're really going to have to persist and keep after them because of the fact they spread underground.
Yeah. Can you just cut them down? And can you just keep cutting them down and kill them that way?
Eventually they'll run out, you know, the reserves will run out, but you could do that in combination with some digging or use a pitchfork and try to pull some up, some of those rhizomes up and then just get all that stuff off the site. And if you're persistent, yeah, eventually you could get them out of there. But also be aware as you do that, you're going to have bare soil. And I think you mentioned there's a slope there. So now your concern is erosion going into that stream or that river that's there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did have a chance to do a quick internet search on just brush management. UW Extension is what I searched on. And we do have a fact sheet on brush management in Wisconsin by Mark Renz. It's a few years old, but like Bruce already mentioned, we've got cultural practices, mechanical, and the chemical or the herbicides. And it gets tricky because of all the nuances with managing this well-established plant and all of the rhizomes that Bruce already mentioned. There are people who are kind of advocating for using goats or sheep or some kind of livestock to do the initial browsing and kind of set those plants back and use that as a method. You need to open up the canopy and encourage something else to kind of fill in where the brambles were. And it gets back to, you know, why are you doing this and what is the goal? And if it's aesthetic and you just don't like the way it looks and you'd rather see a different ecology of plant materials on that sloping, you know, part of land, that's a conversion now from brambles to, you know, more prairie land, upland prairie, you know, so there's lots of options in managing any piece of land. And I would encourage the caller to seek out maybe some local advice from a land and water conservation department in their county, or the USDA has natural resource conservation service departments, or people that have some technical assistance. They, you know, an acre piece of ground is substantial, and we can do a lot of good things to help the ecology and wildlife and birds and other things. And if that's the caller's goal, might look into contacting some of those professionals for their help.
Yeah, that's good advice. Dale, good luck. Appreciate your call very much. Our guest today, Kevin Chesso, Ag Development Educator for Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn Counties, and Bruce Spangenberg, the Extension Horticulture Educator for Iron County. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Garden Talk on Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my two guests, Kevin Chesso, the Ag Development Educator for Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn Counties, and Bruce Spangenberg, who is the Extension Horticulture Educator for Iron County. Questions? Give a call. We'll get you on pretty quickly at 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And you know what? Deb in Janesville and Susie in New Berlin have been waiting a bit. Let's go to Deb in Janesville first. Hi, Deb. Thank you for calling.
So you're welcome. I'm calling in regard to the concern that you were expressing about the oak wilt and the cutting of oak trees in inappropriate times.
Yes.
I'm in Janesville in the stretch of Highway 51 between Janesville and Edgerton. Was recently, I'd say within the last 2 weeks, the trees along the sides of the road were cut back. And I think it was one of those big vertical type saws that its purpose is to cut the trees back away from the highway. But unfortunately, it does a terrible job of kind of mangling all of these trees. And along that stretch, there are lots of oak trees that I saw damaged. Now, my question is, how is that type of work overseen? Who's responsible to make sure that they're not truly damaging some valuable trees versus just doing what they need to do to keep the tree growth further away from the edges of the highway? I'll wait and just listen to your answer, what you think.
Yeah, I think some of that falls under the individual counties, but I know there is a fair amount of education that goes on, but I don't know. Bruce, you want to comment?
Yeah. Well, first of all, that type of pruning equipment, most arborists, professional arborists, look at that and they shudder because, as Deb mentioned, they do mangle. I mean, it's not an efficient – it's efficient as far as time and trying to go through, you know, a lot of brush and, you know, tight branches, that kind of thing along a road or a right-of-way, but – the result, as you see, you don't get good clean cuts, you know, like, you know, we mentioned with pruning the tree, get a good clean cut, it'll callus over quickly. You've got jagged wounds that are left. So as far as who's responsible, that's a tough question because some of that is right away, which I'm assuming then would be the township or the county. And then the contract probably, you know, I'm just guessing it is saying, you know, we need X amount of material removed away from the distance from the road. At the expense, as the caller said, is, you know, you've got some fine oak trees there that might get kind of butchered up as a result versus there may be other stuff in there, brush, you know, box elders and, you know, wild stuff growing. Could even be some buckthorn in there, whatever. So it's all going to get treated the same way, unfortunately. I don't have an easy answer other than start with your town or your township and see, you know, who who oversaw that cutting and expressed your concern if there are oaks in there that you do want, ideally, something done. We're kind of getting close to that window. I know, as Kevin said, we look at usually mid-April as the point where you, once you get to there, don't prune oaks anymore. Wait until the following winter when they're dormant. And if something happens where you do prune them after that, especially when you get into early summer, that's the exception where you definitely do want to treat the wound. Otherwise, we say you don't need to treat wounds. Make a good clean cut. It'll callus on its own. So there's really two issues there. One is the trees themselves. And then, as Deb mentioned, who oversaw that? I'd start with the county or the township and go from there. I don't, Kevin, if you have anything to add to that.
Yeah, well, you know, I just jumped on the Wisconsin DNR Forest Health website, and this is that education piece that's out there. You know, now do the brush companies and, you know, different entities out there, you know, have any awareness of this? Who knows? I mean, that's certainly something that the municipality or somebody who has the contract should at least be acknowledging, is like, we want to follow best management practices. And at some point, like you said, Bruce, in those right-of-ways, certain equipment is considered, you know, normal practices, and we're not talking forest management, we're not talking landscaping, we're talking right-of-way, and it's a different set of lenses as to what vegetation is and how it's valued. So that's the other piece of this. But on this website, they've got a northern zone and a southern zone delineated. But the southern zone says for forestry recommendations, no forest harvesting or cutting of trees, oaks in particular, April 1st through July 15th. That cutting window is, we're in that, so maybe, you know, they're looking the other way, so to speak, or they're within the normal recommended practices because we're still before April 1st.
Yeah.
Now, if this was done in May, maybe there'd be a different story and they couldn't do it. But right, that's what this website is indicating.
There you go, Deb. Thank you so much for calling. Susie in New Berlin, then on to you. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I was listening to you talking about trying to get rid of the wild raspberries, and I was thinking about trying something with my extra wild raspberries that I did last year with buckthorn, and we all know how much fun it is to get rid of buckthorn. What I did last year and the year before, and probably this year, is in the spring, when I figure they're taking in the most, I cut them down fairly close to the ground and then paint each one with full strength Roundup for shrubs. And it has killed them. It doesn't stop the new ones from coming up, but it has killed them every time. So I thought maybe I'd try it with the raspberries, and I thought, maybe, what do you think about? I hate using Roundup, but it's the only thing that'll kill those buckthorn.
Yeah, well, I think it'd take care of those raspberries too, Bruce, that you were talking about earlier.
Yeah, I'm assuming, and again, if in doubt, always look at the product label. But my guess is it would say for general brush control that, you know, cut bark, stem type treatment. And there's a case where you are targeting the herbicide directly. And in the case of glyphosate or Roundup, it does not have soil activity. So that's one of the, you know, pluses there. You don't have to worry about other vegetation nearby unless you actually contact it with the herbicide. Certainly wear gloves. You know, look at all the precautions on the label. And the other thing, you mentioned timing with most woody plants, and that includes brambles coming up. They're at a weak point when they leaf out, trees in particular, but also brush in the spring, because they spend a lot of energy breaking bud. And now you got them at a weak point. So if you cut them and then hit them with a herbicide, that's an effective time to do it. That comes back to the, you know, what Kevin alluded to, the best management practices or sound IPM practices. You know, we're looking at trying to minimize chemical use. And when we use chemicals, use them at the absolutely best time to get the job done. And here's a case where you had some success with the buckthorn, and odds are it would work on the brambles. Double check the labels, you know, make sure you wear protective equipment, and certainly avoid any contact of that herbicide in any plants that you intend to keep, because it is non-selective. It will kill, potentially kill any plant that you apply it to.
Yeah. Susie, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. And by the way, Bruce, we got an email from Lori who says, it's great to hear your voice, Bruce. They too are McHenry County transplants, but they went to Iron County, Michigan.
Okay.
She says, you always did a great job at Garden Fest. So.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Thanks. Yeah. That was a day-long program that went back to the late 80s. Yeah, every set, we had it once a year. It was a full-day program with multiple sessions. Well, thank you. Yeah.
Lee in Williams Bay, your turn. Hi, Lee.
Oh, hi, Larry. I have a question on pruning. I have a Schefflera that goes outside all summer and fall, and then I bring it in, of course, in the winter. But my 8-foot ceiling, it's cramped this winter, and I think I'm going to have to, in the fall of next year when I bring it in, it'll need to be pruned, and I don't have a clue on how to prune it safely.
Hmm. Well,
that's a different
one. Bruce, what do you think?
That's a different one. Normally you're not pruning those too much, but the basic guideline on that, you know, you can reduce the size. Just like I mentioned earlier, when you cut back, make sure there's a branch there or a side shoot that you're cutting to. Don't just leave a stub. And with most houseplants, the better time to try to do that is as the days get longer. So now is actually a good time to start working on houseplants. And you may want to consider reducing its size while it's still outside in the summer. And then because the problem in fall, as you move into fall, there's a shock on plants bringing them back in the house. And the days are getting shorter, so it's not a time where they grow vigorously. So they don't respond real well when you do major things like cutting back their size. So I kind of look ahead and work on the size even now or when you move it outside in the summer, and then get it back to the size you want while it's still under good growing conditions, and then bring it in back in the house in the fall at a size that's going to be smaller and better suited for the house where it's going to sit all winter.
Yeah, I think that's a smart way to do it. Lee, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Let's go to Judy in New Berlin next. Hi, Judy.
Hi. Yeah, I often plant start seedlings. But this year I have new seed and I'm not having great luck. My leeks didn't come up. celery came up. I planted Brussels sprouts that didn't come up, and also mesclun, the lettuce. I had a variety, but it looks like I'm getting all black-seeded Simpson. So I don't know why these seeds now this year are not working. And I have a lot of other seeds that, of course, I haven't used yet, but I hope they'll be better.
Did you say that these are new seeds? You bought the packs this year, Judy?
Yes, I just bought them.
Okay. Uh-huh. And how long has it been? Have they been?
Well, with the leeks, it's been almost a month. Mm. And usually like 2 weeks or so we'll do it. And then Brussels sprouts, the cabbage came up like a week ago already, and the Brussels sprouts don't really show anything.
Hmm.
Yeah, it's hard to say when we have experience and then things don't always work, you know, and that's the luck of the draw or just gardening. and it could be bad seed, you know. Now you would hope the person, you know, the company or the seed supplier is doing germ tests and providing, you know, quality seeds to, you know, their customers. So let's rule that out as not being the issue. You know, old seed we know will lose germ, you know, so far what you've been telling me, you know, it's like, that's very interesting. So now is there something in your seed starting protocol that might be causing, you know, poor germination, whether it be underwater, overwater, you know, I don't know the specifics on all seed requirements as far as some need light soil cover, some might need a little bit of light to germinate. But if you've gotten experience doing this in the past, and you're doing everything the same, I'm not quite sure what to tell you. Patience. You know, I've certainly had seeds go 3 weeks or more and then all of a sudden decide to grow. But maybe it's too warm. Maybe it's too cold. I mean, there's all these little variables that maybe causing, you know, poor germination. So I don't know, maybe you try to change the environment, move these seeds to some other location to change the environment to see if that doesn't spur them along. But kind of stumped here. If you've done this before, you know, overwatering is our number one concern, because we get too wet, we'll rot the seed, right? So if you're not overwatering and you got a little bottom heat, should see something after 3-4 weeks, right?
Yeah, and especially because in some of the seeds are growing properly, and some aren't. So right. It makes me wonder about the seed. Junie knows what she's doing, sounds like, for sure.
Well, you could just start. You could start another batch and just see, you know, if for some reason that first batch just somehow, you know, rotted out or died, and, you know, just do another. There's always this towel test to test germination. You know, that's another option. But, you know, this time of year, it's like just maybe do another planting if you've got extra seeds and see if you can't have better luck a second time.
Yeah, I'd be tempted to just go into one of the little pots and, like on the leeks, and just check and see what the see if there's anything going on in there with one of them, just to see. You might find that there's something going on.
Sometimes this just brought up when you said digging around. We've had poor germination because the mice come in there and they eat the seeds on us. So I don't know if that's the case here, but that sometimes happens where, you know, they mysteriously, you know, don't germinate because the seeds have been eaten. So that's another consideration that might be in play here. You'd obviously think you would see some evidence of that, but maybe not. You know, maybe they're very good at covering their tracks. But mice have been known to take seeds out of seed starting trays. Given the chance to, or eating the little seedlings after they come up.
Yeah. Judy, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Jill and Racine will give you a chance. Hi, Jill.
Hi, Larry and guests. Everything in my garden is really nice except kale. It tastes bitter, but then I'm comparing it to store-bought kale. Is there something I can do to make it less bitter, or is that the way it's supposed to taste?
Yeah, kale always tastes better to me. I don't know. What do you guys think?
I don't know. Sometimes, you know, go ahead, Kevin. Go ahead. You pretty well more kale than
I was going to say, you know, there are varieties of kale that might taste better than others. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you're new to growing kale, maybe try some different varieties and look specifically at the seed packet and see if they say, you know, it doesn't have as much bitterness, because you're right. You know, Larry mentioned it. You know, some people don't necessarily like kale because it tends to have, you know, some of those stronger flavors. So you could try with different varieties. That might do it. And then stress plants tend to get off flavor.
Yeah.
So if your plants are stressed, maybe they go through some dry periods, and you know, that'll impart some off taste bitterness, or we get these alkaloids that build up in the plant and make it taste different. So it could be a stress plant, or in how you prepare it, maybe, you know, you soak it, now you get into the culinary aspects of what you can do to improve a plant that you don't like necessarily. So those are just some of my initial thoughts.
Yeah. I was going to mention the stress that, you know, heat or drought both can impact flavor.
Yeah, absolutely. Jill, there you go. Thank you for calling. Dave Anasio, what's on your mind?
I just wanted to follow up on previous comments about oak wilt. We have a 20-acre forest here in the managed forest program. Yeah, they came through with the machines late in the season and got them stuck. And after they left, it was a mosh pit, and we had oak wilt after that. And I just wanted to mention there are programs available to help landowners, remediate that, thin it out, prune and stuff. It does take some time for them to get in, for you to get paid, but there is a landowner program out there. I do have one question, though.
Sure.
I just wanted, for your experts there, could you compare our forest management activities in Wisconsin to that of another country like Finland or Sweden? I mean, if they're the benchmark, give them an A or something, where are we at?
Okay. I'm not sure we can do that, but you guys have any you're both looking like you may not have an answer, but maybe you do. Kevin, what do you think?
Dave brings up, there's always good reason to question practices, and we can always do better. And we got to put the lens on of, why are we doing this? What's the goal? Like I said, and everybody's got different motivations. And, I want to say bottom line is, sometimes it's motivated by profit versus ecology or whatever. So we do have forest professionals, consultants, agency people who all have lots of education in forest management practices, and I'm sure they're well schooled on some of the practices that are happening in other countries, in those Northern European countries that Dave mentioned. So I'm hopeful that our boots on the ground consultants who are helping landowners with these forest management questions have a pretty good lens on the pros and cons of some of these different practices. But, you get advice from lots of different people, you're going to get 10 different answers, right? So as a landowner, I would just continue to ask questions. And it's your land, it's your property to manage the way you want. And if you don't like the answer you heard from the first consultant or forester,
try another one.
Yeah. Right?
On that note, we are out of time, but I hope you guys will come back and be with us again. Loved having you today, and we'll look forward to another visit from Kevin Chesso, Ag Development Educator for Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn Counties, and Bruce Spangenberg, the Extension Horticulture Educator for Iron County. They'll be back, and we'll talk with them again. There's lots to talk about in the coming months. Monday, Big River Magazine editor Reggie McLeod back to talk about the driftless area, and then the weather guys will join in to talk about the wacky spring weather. In the meantime, thank you for listening. Have a safe and snowy weekend here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.